to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Elle Marr. She is the number one Amazon charts best-selling author of Your Dark Secrets, The Alone Time, The Family Bones, Strangers We Know, Lies We Bury, and The Missing Sister. Originally from Sacramento, Elle graduated from UC San Diego before moving to France, where she earned a master's degree from the Sorbonne. She now lives and writes in Oregon with her family. And you can find out more about her at ellemarr.com, which is ellemarr.com. And the book we're talking about today is her newest, The Lie She Wears. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Elle.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Now, this is a psychological thriller, psychological
it
suspense.
Is.
That's now, are all your books in that category?
They're all in that vein, except for Your Dark Secrets is more of a romantic thriller. But
okay.
The rest of them are definitely all psych thrillers or psychological suspense.
And what drew you to that genre?
I first fell in love with it maybe 15 years ago, and I just was so propelled to turn the pages, rather. Like, it was a very immersive experience, and I would just wake up, you know, essentially an hour after beginning to read and not know how much time had passed. And it's something that I strive to create for my readers.
Wow. Now, I love reading this type of book, and they do seem to have really become more and more popular over the years, especially ones with female lead characters. But I would think they'd be really hard to write, because you have to come up with all these twists and turns. How do you do that?
You know, that's an excellent question. For me personally, I'm constantly consuming headlines. I think a lot of us do these days. And whenever a headline stays with me, I write it down. And so when I'm plotting my next book, because I do plot, I tend to scan my list. And the twists and turns in reality are unmatched, right? So creating something that's twisty and exciting and hopefully unexpected in fiction, for me, is much easier. It's much less daunting task than sometimes reading all the headlines.
Yeah, there's nothing stranger than the truth, right? It's like,
right.
It's like things that happen in real life. They wouldn't be believable in fiction, but they
that's
actually
absolutely
happen.
Right.
Yeah. So your new book, The Lies She Wears, is set in the art world. Your main character is an art curator. What inspired
Correct.
You to set your novel in the art world?
Well, for The Alone Time, which is one of my previous books released last year, I had two books released last year, and The Alone Time features an artist who is launching her first gallery exhibit. She's an postmodern sculpturist, essentially. And I did a lot of research on the art world then for that book, The Alone Time. And then prior to that, when I was doing my master's at the Sorbonne, I did a lot of research in the Biennale in Venice and the other Biennales or biennials around the world, which are a significant event in the art world. So I kind of have been cobbling together details over the last decade or so. And it's just always struck me as a really fascinating world. Specifically, art curation, to choose a profession where you are constantly surrounded by stories, but never really knowing their ending or their origins properly. I think that's fascinating. and I thought I would explore that in this book and see how Pearl's story, when she's kind of at odds with her mother and muddling through this mystery that comes to her door, while also meddling through the mysteries of her work and art curation. I thought that was a fun juxtaposition.
Oh. So, and her focus, Pearl's focus, is on these masks. And I'm guessing that was inspired by your research on the Venetian Biennale that you talked about, because isn't masks a big part of that?
It is. Venetian masks come, they date back to centuries, like millennia, more than that. And Venetian masks for anyone who isn't familiar with them, are the wall art masks that sometimes have really long noses that look like plague masks, but they're more artistic. And Venetian masks a long time ago in Venice were worn by everyone. It wasn't just an aristocratic thing. Everyone wore them. And so it provided a sense of anonymity that allowed people from all classes to perform acts for good and acts a little more rooted in vice. And it was just kind of a thing, which I also found really fascinating in my research. And so that was in part my inspiration for including Asian art masks as a central point in this story, The Lie She Wears. And then also my grandparents collected those.
Seriously?
My grandparents had wall art masks. Yeah,
oh, wow.
It was always something. They're beautiful, but also really creepy in the dark.
Yes, of course, of course. That was one of the other things I wanted to ask you about is that Pearl is Chinese American, and most of her family are all Chinese American. But you don't really, you kind of hint about it in the book, but it doesn't seem to be a major aspect of her character. And I'm curious about why you chose to do that.
Yeah, that's a great question. I have definitely centered identity more in my other books. This is The Lie She Wears is my seventh book. And in previous books, I've made that much more of a central theme and question as readers are, or as my characters are struggling through a conflict and a mystery, they're also having to confront themselves and think about their identity. And in The Lie She Wears, Pearl is Chinese American and her family's Chinese American, and with also some mixed race individuals in there. And they come from Portland, they come from New York. They have backgrounds where the prior generation were immigrants. And so there's a much more recent hovering theme of the immigrant experience, but it's not Pearl's experience, if that makes sense. She's a second generation Chinese American. And so it's there, but it's not so central to her survival. And I deliberately did that because oftentimes I'm Chinese American. I'm actually first generation. And I've learned over the years talking to friends and reading that these children tend to get their cultural experiences from their mothers. I don't want to discount fathers, especially not in today's much more active age, but typically it's mothers that pass on culture. And Pearl experienced a rupture with her mother. She experienced a break with her mother early on where they never really clicked. They never really saw eye to eye. And she's always kind of struggled with having a present mother who's not emotionally present, if that makes sense. So her cultural identity is there, but it's something she mourns as not having a greater tie to throughout the book, especially because she's having to really dig into her mother's past and what makes her mother her, which, our culture is really indivisible from ourselves, whether that's a more recent immigrant culture or American culture. You really can't separate yourself. You are the fish that grew up in the fishbowl, for better or for worse. And so she has to look at all these different questions in her life in order to really pursue the mystery that's at hand.
So it's interesting that that her mother was the one who collected these masks and was really into antiques and art. And yet when Pearl chose that for a career, her mother wasn't happy about it. Why was that?
Well, I think, let me back up. The Lie She Wears, just to give everyone a brief overview of the
story.
Yeah,
maybe we should do that first. Good idea.
Just to ground everyone, because I'm gonna continue to throw out little details. The Lie She Wears follows art museum curator Pearl as she receives a letter from her recently deceased mother, Sally. The letter is actually a confession to murder. So Pearl thinks that she's uncovered her mother's darkest secrets. But when more letters surface and new victims appear, Pearl realizes she's caught in a deadly game of cat and mouse. Someone is following in her mother's footsteps and they're getting closer. It's set in Portland in the Willamette Valley. just outside of Portland. And it really delves into how well we know the people we love and what happens when decades-old secrets refuse to stay buried. So it's my seventh thriller. I'm very, very excited for readers to discover it November 18th. And it's got one of my favorite twists that I've ever written. So I'm super excited.
Now, one of the themes of it is also serial killing and sort of true crime. Pearl's friend in the museum is focusing on crime memorabilia or photograph, which is that an actual like something that you'll find in museums?
I haven't discovered one myself, but it's a growing field. It's had a lot of interest the last 15, 20 years. So it wouldn't surprise me if there is some kind of pop-up exhibit, much like what's discussed in The Lie She Wears, featuring items. I know that there are true crime conventions that do exactly that feature items from well-known crimes, and they're essentially a roadshow. They're taken around and visitors can buy a ticket and go and see the weapon used in a crime that's not been, thoroughly solved.
Oh, wow. I mean, I can certainly imagine the popularity of that for the Jack the Ripper or something like that. But
yeah,
when you get a little closer to current time, I find that really
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
And I don't think you're not going to see anything from recent crimes out there, but I know that there are true crime conventions that do have, I won't call it memorabilia, but I think they just have a section called evidence. And it's all stuff that's been cleared, that's been released, that's been bought at auction, all legally sourced. But that really caught my attention for the research of this book, as well as writing my next book, which I'm currently editing with my editor.
Why would somebody want to something like that?
I don't know.
Oh, yeah. So how common are female serial killers? Or how uncommon are they, should I say?
They are, well, based on what we know, which is that serial killers typically are somewhere, they're usually driven by not psychopathic needs or sociopathic needs. Usually they are, or they have some element of that, but it's a lot less, I want to say, glamorous, exciting, sexy than what movies present. From what's known, it's suggested that there are frequent female serial killers are much more numerous than we would suspect. And that's because female serial killers usually have some element of sociopathy, psychopathy, that makes them better at blending. Women in general are thought to be better at masking than men. And so that extends to those who commit violent crimes. It's an ongoing field of research, of course. But I found that to be interesting. They're thought to be more numerous than is known. And I know the FBI is like a solid database on known serial killers or suspected serial killers. But female serial killers, they are a burgeoning pie slice of that study.
Wow, so. I had no idea. Do they tend to do female serial killers tend more often to their victims or people that they know rather than strangers?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Female serial killers tend to target people that they know that they've had a significant interaction with versus male serial killers do not. They're more frequently into people they don't know,
yeah.
Targeting people they don't know.
Wow. So some of the cases that talk about the kind of true crime cases in the book, are they all real or did you make those up?
Oh, completely fictitious.
Okay.
Completely. I've never used real events or real names. I would never, because I think the truth is so much harder to transcribe than to just make it up. and to, you know, I think I've mentioned one or two like major names, but I've touched on true crime themes before in my books, and I'm always very careful to make it up. But there are some events that have inspired my work. So
such as
there's a lot to pull from out there.
Such as
well, for Lies We Buried, that was my second book. It came out in 2001. It centers around a storyline of women who were abducted and then held falsely imprisoned for years and years, and they then each became pregnant by their captor and had babies while imprisoned. And those babies grew up to be my main characters, who have to kind of battle the onset of new crimes that resemble their origin story of how they were born into the world in false imprisonment. And so that was a story inspired by a case that occurred in Austria, which anyone who follows true crime will probably be familiar with it. The names escape me now for good reason, but it's horrific. It's horrific. It was a father who imprisoned his daughter. And then there's another, there's the Cleveland House of Horrors that also occurred at, about 10 years ago, 15 years ago. And really, as I was researching that book, Lies We Bury, I found that there are a lot of too many stories of false imprisonment, all of it very disturbing. So it's for that reason I never use real names, except for, like, I think I mentioned Manson in one or two of my books, purely because these survivors have been through enough and they don't deserve to be exploited for my pages. Wow. But there's a lot to pull from out there. And The Lies She Wears really skirts true crime in that it discusses photography from a museum perspective for a pop-up exhibit. But even then, I got to really delve into local history, which was eye-opening. If you go back far enough, there's some interesting things in any location you're at.
I bet. Well, that was the thing. One of the kind of clues or hints that was showing up were these postcards that Pearl's parents' father were receiving, and her museum friend identifies each of the places of the postcards are being, they're postcards from a certain city, although I don't know that they're necessarily postmarked in those cities, but the postcard itself is of that city. And he says, oh, that's where this crime happened, that's where this crime happened. But isn't it kind of true that probably every single city out there, there's some famous true crime that's happened?
Exactly. There is. And it's just a matter of how much social media light has been thrown on it. There are, everyone has their unique lore. Every city has their unique lore.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I, you know, following your lead, I'm not going to talk about the one in my hometown of Fairfield, Iowa, actually there's been several, but one that happened many years ago that was really quite horrific, but it was solved. It wasn't an unsolved one, but we don't talk about it in our town. It never comes up.
Yeah. Collective trauma.
Yeah.
I believe that. There's a lot to work through there.
Yeah. And it is a small town, and so
everyone's probably connected in some way or another, right?
probably. And it was a case of a woman murdered her very abusive husband, so there were two sides to the story, I guess you'd say.
Sure. Yeah.
But
yeah,
she did it in a pretty horrific way. But and then was found not guilty by reason of insanity. Yeah.
Wow. Well, you're giving listeners a lot to Google.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's quite a story.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. So I expect you spent some time in the Portland Art Museum as part of.
Yes, it's a beautiful building. It's located in downtown Portland, right across from Park City Blocks, which is this beautiful green space that also features in the book In the Lie She Wears. The Portland Art Museum is gorgeous. It's expansive. I actually thought about hosting my wedding there. They have a giant ballroom. I did not. Spoiler. Spoiler did not. But it's this beautiful historic building right in the middle of downtown Portland, which itself is beautiful and green and peaceful. And it's this really nice location near Portland State University as well. So it's central. You can walk everywhere. My character can run into trouble and also run back to safety. It's the perfect setting. And of course, the halls are just rife with artwork and beautiful masterpieces. You've got Jackson Pollock pieces, you've got Monet's, you've got I think there's oh, is there a Renoir? I think there's a Renoir in there for all the art buffs. Really great tableaus and also some amazing sculptures, and they have a significant section on Native American art. So it's got everything that I needed from my book, as well as some creepy short hallways that turn suddenly and you're not really sure what's around the corner. Is it an art museum exhibit or is it someone waiting for you? There's a lot to unpack, and it also recently served as a setting for the Portland Book Festival, which is always a great time. So yes, I've spent some time in the Portland Art Museum and I would highly recommend it.
Now, were you able to actually visit the storage areas? Because they feature pretty prominently in the book, too.
I was not. They, to no surprise to anyone, they protect their artwork and they don't just let a nosy writer come in and start taking pictures. But I did have the luxury of correspondence with one of the art museum curators on staff, and so she answered a lot of my questions and directed me some great websites. Wikipedia, Google actually had really great specs on the property layout of the museum. And then I also did some research through the Smithsonian, who offers, I want to say, not how-tos, but just has published PDFs on art museum curation and how the Smithsonian does it specifically. So I definitely centered most of my research on the Portland Art Museum, but the Smithsonian managed to make an appearance in my work, and their content was super helpful.
Did it make you want to be a museum curator?
I have always wanted to be a museum curator. Just like I've always wanted to be a librarian.
Of course, of course. Yeah, I just found it really fascinating, these pop-up exhibits, how they come to be, and they're trying to center around the story and how important storytelling really is in the human experience in many, many ways. Even in business, the businesses that succeed today are ones that are telling a story and that people connect with. And that story is how we connect with So,
Yeah,
yeah.
absolutely.
So being a museum curator in a way is not that different from being a writer.
I 100% agree. I have great respect for storytellers of all kinds and always have. And that was only confirmed in researching how art curation comes about, and the work that goes into it. The teams of people that put together an exhibit is really impressive. And I, in my little civilian mind, did not grasp how many hands touch an exhibit, let alone the people who own the pieces and then lend them to the museum, or if the museum happens to come by ownership themselves of items. There's a lot of red tape and logistics that go into it.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is L. Marr, author of The Lie She Wears. I'm curious, what happened to your grandparents' mask?
Oh, they are sitting in my aunt's house. My grandparents passed a good many years ago, and so they are, I believe the masks are sitting in my aunt's house,
Does she
waiting
just
for the day when I can get my hands on them.
display any of them?
No, she doesn't. I think she also found them to be creepy.
Yeah.
They're beautiful. They were beautiful. They were the much more benign versions. You know, I won't say touristy versions, but they were really petite, not even like a full, like a child's face could fit into it. My child's face fit into it when I was a kid. And they were just decorated in really beautiful ways with rhinestones and sparkles and splashes of color. And then like others were decorated a la, you know, with polka dots in a really wide range of presentation. So I first was inspired by those masks that I grew up walking by in their hallway, and then learned that there were so many other Venetian masks that those are just like the more modern day palatable versions of these much more intricate and ornate masks that were used all the way in the early millennium.
Now, you said that the Venetian masks were worn by everyone, not just the noble people, but was that only during the festival or was it other times as well?
Anytime, day or night, which I found really surprising.
Yes.
Everyone's equal. I mean, Venice is a very small island. I actually used to live in France for 3 years. And so I did a fair amount of travel while I was there. And it's just an island. It's just a tiny little floating bit. And so everyone knows each other. A very small town, especially back then, you had to take a boat to get in. And so I think that may have been the appeal in donning anonymity when everyone knows your business. Yeah. Otherwise.
But of course, if you have a unique mask, everybody's still going to know.
Oh, yes. Very true. And they didn't wear them all the time. They just wore them whenever they felt like it or during festivals.
Wow.
So if you know, someone's buying eggs, they just happen to show up in a mask. No one says anything.
So you mentioned living in France. So I assume that was when you were studying at the Sorbonne. What were you studying?
I got a master's in international studies, international relations, and I also studied that in undergrad. And it centered a lot around actually Anglo-American cultural influence, which was also, it dovetailed nicely with my purposes of writing and being there while I was writing. And really, it was interesting to see the French perspective on American culture, and then also the British perspective on American culture, which played a role in that field of study. So it was kind of just, I found a master's that suited my existing knowledge and my existing interest, which is being an American abroad.
Oh, okay.
And then managed to write several papers in French and English and study a lot about the Anglo-American sphere, cultural sphere. And then that was it. That was it. That was a lot of reading and then writing. And it was a beautiful, very exciting time in my life. And I first went over there teaching English, which is how I got there anyway, in my mid-20s. And so it was a really great bookend to then earn a master's at the end of that experience.
So you were studying in French?
It was a bilingual master's, yes.
Bilingual master's.
So because it was Anglo-American, you had to speak English, and I already spoke English, but then I had to prove that I spoke French at a university level.
Wow.
So
how did you become fluent in French? Was that you studied high school, or you grew up learning it, or?
I did not grow up learning it. No one in my family speaks French except for me now. And I got exposed to it in middle school, high school, college as well, but I never majored in it. I never minored in it. I would have loved to have minored in French literature, but I didn't have enough credits. So I just enjoyed it. And then when I was in my 20s having a quarter life crisis, I decided that I didn't want to do what I was doing, which was being on track to go to law school. And I instead said, well, what do I like to do? And yes, was speaking French, traveling, and learning about other cultures. And so I found a program to teach English abroad for anybody, not just students, because I was now several years outside of undergrad. And I got waitlisted, and then I got accepted. And so I went. And then I thought I was only going to stay for 9 months, but I ended up staying for 3 years. So wow. Staying for 3 years got me fluent.
Yeah, I think that would do it. So did you ever work in that field?
In international studies?
Yeah, yeah.
Only if you count writing, being an author. Otherwise, I would have loved to have gone to DC or work in like an NGO somewhere. But my path didn't take me there. So I instead discovered writing while I was living in France. So it would have been nice to then parlay the master's into something in an international field. But then I fell in love with writing and I was able to, have a career as a published author. So this was my passion all along. So I'm happy with where it took me.
Okay. Well, we'll come back to that, you know, how you actually started publishing and so forth in a little bit. But I'm curious. So you're writing in France. Did you go sit in cafes and write?
No, because they don't have those. They have those in Paris. But even then, I mean, now they do. Now everyone has a laptop. Now everyone has a cell phone. But I was there in the 2010s, like early 2010s. And so smartphones were not a thing. Smartphones really exploded here around 2013, 2015. They were everywhere, like late early aughts. But in France, everyone in France always says they're about 10 years behind the United States. And so that was true technologically then. I had a flip phone. And then I had like a little old-fashioned BlackBerry with like a keypad you could type on. But
no laptop.
I had a laptop, but it just stayed at home. Or I took it to school when I was teaching at the local university. I was teaching English there. But you don't walk around with a Starbucks cup. You don't walk around with your head in your phone. You didn't bring your laptop to go and work in cafes unless you're in Paris proper. And I was in the suburbs.
Ah, okay.
So it was a different experience. I wrote in my apartment.
Okay. So did you at least have a view over the rooftops or something?
Oh, I gotta tell you, I lived in Rouen. I first lived in like the more like very close outskirts of Paris. And then I moved to Rouen, which is the site of Joan of Arc's very harrowing death, burning at the stake. So that was my view. I had a view of the square, which is this beautiful square today. But that was my view's claim to fame.
Well, no wonder you wrote psychological suspense thrillers. And
let me tell you, Annika, there's stuff around every corner there. We talk about every town here has a story. In Europe, in France, every quarter has a story, and there's a lot to pull from.
I bet. Why don't you read a little bit from The Lies She Wears?
I would love to. Okay. So this is chapter 2 from Pearl's perspective, and it begins. Everyone harbors secret fears, a creature under the bed, a stranger following us home, an image burned into the mind's eye from a horror film viewed at a too young age. Not everyone chooses to specialize in their fear. Plywood shipping boxes, plastic containers, and high-tech steel-reinforced cases overflow the storage docks of the windowless warehouse hall. Shoddy light bulbs flicker overhead, casting ominous shadows at 9 in the morning. I usually avoid doing this task on my own, but I set my shoulders and clomp forward in my asexual flats anyway, essential footwear for any woman in historical studies. Gunmetal gray scaffolding extends for rows from the doorway where I entered. The numerous aisles still failed to convey the extensive backlog of artifacts waiting to be chosen for display in one of the museum's many exhibit halls. As associate curator, I should be more comfortable searching through the wooden crates and plastic bins, perusing the white sticker labels slapped on top that often include notated shorthand and country abbreviations. But this is my first real museum job as a hired expert. No more seeking coffee orders as an intern. And until now, most of my time has been spent researching my subject. Griffin, my boss and chief curator of the museum, has been dangling a promotion over my head since I was hired 6 months ago. I need to get this right, even if it means staring at the source of my childhood nightmares. A Tibetan mask painted black with white spirals jeers at me through a plastic storage crate. I shudder, turning away. Pearl, right? What's your poison? A man emerges from the third row to my right, wearing blue coveralls and holding a box from this morning's delivery from Seattle. Xander, the director of collections, sports a too chipper grin, considering the ghosts surrounding us. I return his smile. 12th century China. He clicks his tongue, bowing slightly as he flattens a hand across his chest. Oh, right this way. We pass an endless series of tools, then turn right midway down the hall and along older, rusted shelves. A laminated sign announces we're approaching Islamic art as our footsteps echo against Neolithic pottery shards, plaster casts of Greek busts, and other items from the epochs that museum curators deemed too disparate to form a collection worthy of display. When I was first hired as associate curator of Asian art, I was elated, thrilled that my PhD in art history from Stanford wouldn't go to waste and that I'd be one of the youngest associate curators on record at the Portland Art Museum at 27. I was so excited to share the news with my mother, Sally, who first seeded my love of unrestored tapestries found in thrift stores across the greater Pacific Northwest. Then I learned my chief task would be to cobble together an exhibit with zero budget in time for the Halloween season, a massive undertaking. Sally wasn't impressed. When I shared the news, she spilled her tea across the counter deliberately, then told me to clean it up. But that's a bygone worry now, a bittersweet memory, I suppose. A woven straw doll glares at me from a clear circular bin in an aisle dedicated to the Chinook. What are you looking at? After Sally died in a car crash 4 weeks ago, Griffin told me I could take as much time as I needed to process the loss. The offer lifted some of the depression cloud that had been following me, had been trailing me since Sally's diagnosis of cognitive decline. Our cataloging process still needs work, but the next two rows should offer what you need. Xander gives me a thumbs up. You excited for the unveiling of the new floor? If by excited you mean terrified, yes. I offer a smile to soften the vulnerability of my joke, but Xander doesn't laugh. Sure. I was too for my first big project. He nods. You'll do great. I murmur my thanks as he goes, feeling as awkward as when I started back in April, and something scrapes in the aisle behind me. I turn toward the sound, but only shelves of dusty crates face me in response. The aisle extends another 50 feet, replete with half-empty receptacles that offer a view into their contents, deteriorating fabric swatches, thick plastic-wrapped tableau, ancient paintbrushes, and ornate headdresses. You never cared this much about anything, lazy. I step forward, closer to my quarry. A heavy metal door slams shut from the southmost corner of the room. Although the Portland Art Museum offers over 100,000 square feet of gallery real estate, the storage areas occupy another quarter of the property. So many discarded relics that will wait years to see a patron. You care more about this than you do your own mother. I clench my jaw, fighting the urge to argue. Force myself to focus on the labels instead of the haunting echo of my mother's voice. The first week after Sally's death was the hardest. I stayed in my apartment most days, sitting alone on the love seat in front of a Netflix marathon. Then, after the funeral, I started imagining her voice in some twisted form of masochistic grief whenever I began a risky task or project that I knew I wasn't ready for, like cleaning out the gutters of the ranch house. The knee-jerk habit of conjuring up my mother's most disappointed comments has only grown more frequent, more poisonous, recalling her frustration with me. Though I know I'm in control of my thoughts, and even the ones that resemble Sally's oft-voiced opinions of me, the memory of her angry tone is a shock when I'm feeling exposed. I follow the labels, now only haphazardly listening for the scraping noise. At the end of the aisle, where the shelves nearly touch the back wall, the years progress to reach the 12th century and span the continent until China is legible in black ink against white adhesive. "Gotcha," I whisper. "Now who's lazy?" When I learned there were over 4,000 items of Asian art gathered here, ranging from historical to contemporary, from South Asian to East Asian and everything in between, my chest tightened. I was overwhelmed at the thought of how to highlight so many in an exhibit, how to prove myself to my employer in this make or break moment of my budding career. That's about the halfway through the first chapter.
All right. All right. Thank you. That was Elle Marr reading from The Lies She Wears. I'm curious what brought you to Portland, because that is, of course, where this book is set and where you are living now. But you've lived many different other places. So why Portland?
Portland is such a beautiful and impressive city. It's never trying to be something that it's not, which I appreciate. Culturally, its motto is "Keep Portland Weird." And that's exactly what it does. It's quirky. It's respectful of the quirkiness. It celebrates the quirkiness, the weirdness. And then it's also, you know, that phrase in and of itself is like, "Keep Portland Weird," is a declaration and a command. And the city is fiercely protective of its brand as weird and also of its people. You'll see, I mean, it's a very inclusive and accepting and kind place. I have little kids. It's such a great place to raise little kids. There's so many activities indoors because Portland rains. There's a lot of rain, lots of indoor activities, and then a lot of outdoor experiences because it's so beautiful. All of the natural beauty located within an hour's drive rivals that of Hawaii's. And people who are from Hawaii tell me that frequently. And people who visit Hawaii, I've never been myself, but it's got so many waterfalls and great hikes in the surrounding areas, and the downtown itself is so fun and unique and diverse in its boutique shops. It's a really great place to be. So I moved up here with my then boyfriend, now husband, and we just thought it'd be a great spot to be for a little while. And then the pandemic hit and we ended up being here for a lot longer than a little while.
I've visited Portland once, and of course one of the things that you got that Portland's famous for is voodoo donuts, and you mentioned those. Oh, yes. in the Lie She Wears.
yes a couple of little winks for anyone who's been to Portland.
That's right. And it's interesting because I'm sitting in Austin, Texas today. This is my second home is in Austin, and Austin's motto is also "Keep Austin Weird."
I was going to mention Austin and the weird rivalry.
Yes. And now, of course, this is 2025, and Portland has come under a bit of fire from I don't even want to say, you know.
46.
Yeah. Let's just say that. And so what, obviously, you don't find Portland to be a burning.
I think hellscape is the word.
Hellscape. Yeah. So you're there. Give us the truth from the front lines.
Yeah. You know, it's just in a series of silly things that have been said. This to me was like one of the most shocking, silly thing, because anyone who's been to Portland will just laugh and laugh and laugh. Anyone who knows someone who lives in Portland will just laugh and laugh and say, "What a silly thing to say. Portland is not a hellscape." I think the weekend that was said before the ICE agents arrived here and National Guard, my dad was visiting and we were out doing soccer with my little kids and walking around downtown doing the, where did we go? We went to the Saturday market, which is a great outdoor market right along the riverfront. We went to another farmer's market along Portland State University. everyone's out there. It's raining a little bit. Everyone's saying hello, offering free samples to my kids. You know, it's a, what has been characterized as a hellscape literally is taken from 2020 when there were protests across two blocks. And Portland has had its ups and downs since the pandemic. And even, you know, because it's a very proud city of proud people, Portlanders have a history of protesting and showing their disagreement with, you know, federal administration policies. And Portlanders are not shy about it, which I respect. I would think anybody who's a proponent of the First Amendment would agree with that. It's always been peaceful, except for one or two moments in 2020, which is not an accurate representation of today. So, you know, I'm on social media. Anybody who's on social media, feel free to follow me or check out my stories. I'm still posting pictures, whatever I'm out and about downtown or out and saying, still not a hellscape, still beautiful place, still peacefully playing with a bunch of kids at the park. Or doing farmers market in the center of downtown where it's also peaceful. Wow.
By the way, I think it's number 47 we were referring to, not 46. So, 47. Was Portland able to keep the National Guard out, or did they end up coming?
I think there's still some, there's still some legal hoops to jump through there, but I think it's still being decided. So, National Guard has not been here yet.
Oh, good.
I'm aware.
Oh, good. It's hard to know because sometimes the media moves on and you don't really know what's happening, you know,
right,
anywhere. But,
I heard that they were coming, but then they weren't coming. So, my understanding is they're not coming now. Everyone's just kind of rolling their eyes. Here because it's very much not needed.
Well, now we hear it. We hear this. If any of you out there are listening and you don't know what to believe, here's somebody who's there so you can believe her.
Thank you. You know, every city has got their ups and downs and their issues.
Certainly.
But it is not the.
So does every rural area.
Yeah. Very true. I come from a rural area. Yeah. I come from very rural Northern California.
So, Elle, when you started writing, so in France, now, had you as a child, like, thought you wanted to write novels when you grew up, or you said you discovered it in France? So tell me a little bit about that journey.
I always wanted to be a writer. In my great dreams, always wanted to be a writer, but I didn't think I could. I didn't think it was possible. I was a voracious reader, very early reader, and loved the idea of writing, tried writing in my little diaries with the little, you know, plastic lock on it, but never got very far because it was such a daunting idea. And as I got older, I thought, well, you have to have an MFA, you have to go to school for it. And my Chinese immigrant grandparents would never allow me to do that. To invest so much time and energy in an MFA would not have gone over well. And so I just put it out of my mind for the longest time. But it was when I had moved to France, and where I was teaching English and I was snowed in, that I first began thinking in November of that year that maybe I could sit down and just write something for myself and see if it went anywhere. And I began NaNoWriMo, which is the now semi-defunct National Novel Writing Month experience where you write 50,000 words in 1 month.
Oh, it's not still happening? They're not still doing it?
No, they shut down. They shut down early this year.
Oh.
But I just learned that there's a NaNoWriMo 2.0 that's out there.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't think it's... I don't know. They shut down. but way back when, in 2012, they were alive and thriving. And so I started writing my first novel with them and then was delighted to find that I wrote a novel and I also really enjoyed it. And that unlocked a world of possibility for me to know that I could physically, I guess, like mentally do it without going to an MFA program. That was a nice surprise. I really didn't think I could.
And how did you learn how to plot, how to develop character. If you, you know, you can do it. You can learn by doing and by reading and doing, or you can, you know, a lot of people do go to courses, go to workshops. Did you do any of that?
I learned by doing. I learned by writing that first novel and then ripping it apart and revising it for about, 3 years before I finally said, okay, I should probably just let this lie. This is dead. It's not going anywhere, at least not the direction I want. So I put it down and then I started writing another book, which became my debut thriller, The Missing Sister, which published in 2020. But that first book is how I, that was my learning ground. That's how I learned to write. I read a lot of writing, like the Save the Cat writes a novel book, as well as, what is her name? K.M. Weiland has a great series on story structure. Initials K.M. Weiland, W-E-I-L-A-N-D, to give her credit. She was really instrumental in my early writing education as I was first attempting novels. So I just read books on craft. And I also watched a lot of movies, to be honest. Movies and film are so excellent for story structure understanding because they are so precise in their beats. This has to happen at the 25% mark. This must happen at the midpoint of 50%. So if you don't have the time, quote unquote, to read a 300-page novel, although you must read as a writer, you must read books to be a good writer. If you want to slapdash rundown on what story structure is, just watch your favorite movie and note the points at the 25% mark, 50% mark, 75% mark, 33, 67. And those break down, they hit exactly what must happen for the character on that specific journey. So I did a lot of movie watching and craft book reading.
So at what point did you decide this could be a full-time career for you?
Oh gosh. Page 5 of writing my first book.
Really?
My first manuscript. I was naive. I was hopeful. I was stubborn. I thought, well, if someone else can do it, I can do it too.
Wow.
But you know, it took me, I just thought if I thought I was good enough, I thought these first few pages were good enough. There's something there. I thought there was some story to be unearthed after writing my first chapter. And I thought, truly, if someone else could do it and get their start to finish, start writing their book 6 months, day one, know that it's good, finish it 6 months, not have to do an edit, send out to literary agents, land a deal. What a year it's been, which is like a fraction of the 1%, like a fraction of the 1% are able to do that. I thought I could do it too. Spoiler, reader, I did not do that. Like many, many authors, it took me a lot longer than 6 months. From when I started writing in 2012, November 2012, I landed my agent in June of 2018. So it was almost 5.5 years when I first began thinking, I could be a novelist, I could be an author. And then after that, things rolled very quickly. But I spent 3 years on my first manuscript and then spent another 3 years writing and honing my second manuscript, which became my debut thriller, The Missing Sister. So total of about almost 5 years of working until my book was published in 2020. But it was a journey. It was a lot of humbling experiences and growing a thick skin, which is a benefit. You must have it as an author, as a published author. So I look back on those years, not as like times I was dragging my feet and just waiting for a literary agent to sign me or a publisher to take note. It really was my training ground, both in learning story structure and in training myself to believe in myself, because you never stop facing rejection as an author. It's either rejection from publishers, literary agent, if you go back out, or readers, because everyone has an opinion and you must be okay with that.
Well, how long did it take you to, from when you started submitting to an agent to actually get an agent?
Well, I started submitting way too soon with that first manuscript. Way too soon. Like I said, I had a lot of humbling emails sent my way. So yeah, it, probably 5.5 years.
Okay,
Within 6 months of writing that first manuscript, I was like, I've got three edits down, three rounds of edits. I think this manuscript is good to go. Let's send it out, see what the agents say. And the agent said, no. They said, no, thank you.
But what kept you going?
I was looking at this as a career. I wanted to be traditionally published. And I wanted the support of a team behind me. I look at indie authors, self-published authors, and I have so much admiration for their drive and their creativity across the different buckets that must be completed as an author. And I didn't want to do any of that. I just wanted to write, edit, and do a little bit of social media work around a book launch. And I just wanted to write. I knew my strengths were not in managing the other aspects of it. So I wanted a team. I wanted the inherent approval of signing with a literary agent, of someone telling me that I was ready. Because it is such an isolating experience being a writer. And I wanted the broader network of a publisher to assist me in marketing and in selling my book. And I got that in more. I got that in spades with my publisher. So I'm very, very lucky in that respect.
And now you've published 7 books in 5 years?
The Lie She Wears, coming November 8th and 18th, is my 7th book in 5 years. I published 2 books last year. One with Thomas and Mercer, one with Disney Publishing. And it has been a whirlwind. It has been a journey. I've also had 3 little kids.
Oh my
gosh. It's been a lot.
Whoa. Yeah. What, during the same five year period?
Yeah.
That's unbelievable.
That is true. It is. It shouldn't have happened that way. I would not recommend the timing, but I will say I feel incredibly fortunate that everything has worked out as it has. And if you want to support this working mother, go and get The Lie She Wears.
The Lie She Wears. Elmar, thank you for being with us today. And we always close with a quote. And what I found for today is, the closing years of life are like the end of a masquerade party when the masks are dropped, from Cesare Pavese. And I think that fits The Lie She Wears.
Beautiful, beautifully put. I couldn't agree more. That's great.
And thank you, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.